Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 520, States and Stages, with guests Dr. Carol Griggs and Ted Strauss. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Sunday, March 11th, 2018. In this installment of the podcast, I'm going to play a conversation that I recorded just a few days ago with Dr. Carol Griggs and with her business partner and co-founder of a company called iConscious, Ted Strauss. Sea Realm listener Joey, who I met in Peru in 2008, sent me a very enthusiastic endorsement of Dr. Carol Griggs after he had seen her give a live presentation. And I contacted her and we set up this conversation. Actually, this one was to Sea Realm Radio. I am your host, KMO, and I am joined via Skype by Dr. Carol Griggs and Ted Strauss, two folks who are interested in consciousness, and that is a massive understatement. I'm going to ask you to each not give a full bio, but just, if you would, talk for a moment or two about your interest in consciousness or where your concerns lie primarily right now, at this time in history and at this time in your lives and careers. Ted, would you go first?
Sure. Wow, that's a big question. I've spent my entire life on the journey that I originally thought of as a spiritual one. And so consciousness is the most modern word I associate with that. And but most recently, my interest is in helping everybody in the world awaken to their own consciousness and go far beyond that in the way that they evolve in their personal development, which to both Carol and I means it's got to be in an integrated way, not just consciousness. So that's the main header.
Yeah, so my interest is very similar. I'm most interested in human potential. And so one of the biggest pieces Ted and I both found, not only in our personal lives, but also professionally and academically in research, is consciousness at the helm of that. And so we're both interested in consciousness evolution, as well as other aspects of our being, such as emotional intelligence, body awareness, and things like that, that also affect one's potential. And so we're interested in that, and also the intersection of technology and utilizing various technological tools to scale the human potential movement, if you will.
Yeah, that's where we're really spending our time right now. We're applying everything we've learned in our lives and from everything we've researched and studied about the human potential movement and how it's turned in some ways very integral, and in other ways, just very deep and widely informed from the world's wealth of resources. And we're trying to find the best of that and figure out how to make that inform artificial intelligence so that AI can help us all be our best and be most fulfilled, and also create technologies that preferably won't kill us.
Are you talking about friendly AI, so-called?
Exactly, friendly AI, which actually relates to one of our current projects, which is called Loving AI, in which we're studying exactly that, some basic aspects of how AI can be friendly and loving and, let's say, have a very positive impact on the development and the feelings of love of those who interact with it.
Well, that's an area of great interest to me, but before we get there, let's go a little slow here at the beginning. What should people take you, each of you, to mean when you use the word consciousness?
Oh, great question. Yeah, to me, I define consciousness as that which notices all experience. In other words, consciousness is transcendent. The way I would say it in scientific terms is below the Planck constant. You can't measure it. It's not manifest, but it's what actually registers what's happening in, you could say, through embodied experience. So it's not separate from embodied experience. It's an aspect of embodied experience, but it itself is that which transcends all experience. That would be my definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the only thing I would probably add is it transcends and includes it. It transcends it, and it also is everything. So it registers our experience and actually is our experience at the same time. And I know that sounds right. very kooky, but there are various stages to realizing aspects of consciousness. And so transcending and including it would be that's
a nice way to put it. I'm glad you said that, because to me, whenever you speak of the mystery of consciousness, you can't help but speak to the mysterious paradox that somehow combines consciousness with the rest of the universe and our personal embodiment. And I think, you know, to us, the ultimate integration there is the fact that, well, yeah, being is one thing and it always was. We're just talking about the evolution of human perception of being, right? So in the evolution of the human perception of being, we go through the stages as described in our model, the iConscious Human Development Model. And basically, that model is describing not only stages of development of consciousness, but of our whole being. And it shows how we get integrated as we evolve. And so really, we're talking about as we evolve, we discover more and more the details and the subtlety of this paradox of apparently everybody being separate and also being exactly the same thing as one being. And again, to us, it's only a paradox because it seems to be early in our development. And as we naturally grow, the paradoxes vanish and we just find ourselves part of what is, simultaneously perceiving as separate in some ways, like through our eyes and parts of our brain, but knowing that it's all the same thing.
And so these are actually what we're describing are actually stages of development. So, you know, people often perceive themselves as separate from themselves and life and others as a stage of development. And as people evolve, that perception starts to shift. They start to see a little bit differently and experience a little bit differently. And so that's what Ted is referring to in the iConscious model. That is free for anybody who wants to go check it out. And they can take an assessment to figure out where they are in their developmental process, in consciousness evolution, in their purpose, uniqueness, in heart emotions development, emotional intelligence, as well as mind and body. So each one of those evolves and develops for different people at different rates. And some people are more evolved in certain aspects than others. And so that is part of actually what our work is what happens when somebody is more developed or underdeveloped in certain aspects. If they're more developed in consciousness and less developed in heart, you know, what are the problems that arise in their lives personally and professionally, and their just experience of themselves and life, or, you know, and any variations of the developmental process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If I may, I just quickly add to that, I think another thing we would say about that is that what we find in general is that the less integrated the five domains are as we're developing, the more stress there is, the slower is our overall development, and the more stress there is going on. And so that's one of the reasons we're so, you know, we really emphasize the importance of integration.
So you're using the word integration frequently, and I know I've listened to your interview with Buddha at the gas pump, so I know that you are familiar with and are actually taking some material from Ken Wilber in Integral Psychology. That's a pretty daunting, complicated system, and it's one that a lot of people, myself included, don't have much appetite for. How much right. of that have you incorporated into your own thinking on consciousness? And what's the minimum that somebody should know about it in order to follow what you're saying?
You know, I actually don't think that you need to really understand, quote, integral theory or integral psychology or have read all of 25 or 35 of Ken Wilber's books. I mean, Ken's brilliant. And so we have certainly drawn from some of his work to inform our model, as we have drawn from a ton of other researchers and theorists over the last however many decades. And so you really don't have to. Part of the thing that we wanted is that we don't want people to have had a ton of other experience in other, you know, other research that's been done. We wanted to bring this down to the ground where people could access this, whether they have academic knowledge of some of the other philosophers or not. And so whether you have an appetite for Ken Wilber's work or not, or if it's too, you know, if it's too wordy or if it's just too academic or any of that stuff, that we wanted to make this model accessible and usable to the general public.
Right. So, yeah, perfect. Exactly. That, you know, Ken's like one of these, well, he's sort of a little, reminds me of my dad, you know, who's an engineer on some of these early NASA rockets. You know, he's working at this level that's like right at the most subtle stuff with his incredible brain and his incredible awareness, his incredible consciousness, and he integrates this stuff. And I know he's trying more and more to bring it to the ground now, but his, you know, the main body of his work prior to recently has been really in guiding people like us to help us understand what are the major axes that must be considered when you're thinking about human potential, consciousness, and any kind of human development. And he, you know, his system, he sort of reduced it to five axes, we could say. And what we've noticed is that, like, that's brilliant. It's really true, exactly what he came up with. It cannot be denied that those five must be taken into consideration in everything we're doing in our work. Absolutely. It also seems to be true that as soon as you try to show somebody five dimensions at once, they go cross-eyed. So we have done our own way of interpolating this into the iConscious model so that everything that he was talking about is represented within the three dimensions of the model. Yeah, if you want to get into details about that, we can. But basically, that's the idea. We're just trying to keep it simple.
And obviously, anytime you take five dimensions down to three, it becomes simplified and you lose something, obviously, within that process. But in our model, we do include all of that. And then the other piece, though, is we've actually gotten more specific in the later stages of development in a way that's not yet been done by a lot of researchers for multiple reasons that I don't know that we really want to get into now. But that is something that the iConscious model brings to the table that's not yet been done, is what happens after a consciousness awakening, what happens after a heart awakening, what happens after a gut awakening, and what are those stages of development after somebody has gone through something like that, and what does it look like? And so that was something that felt really important to both Ted and I, as we've both worked with thousands of clients in that process of what are the patterns that we've seen with people over time. And we wanted to include that as part of the map and model as well, because there are more and more people now having different kinds of awakenings that don't have a sense as to, well, what now? Like, everything's feels new, like my life has kind of started over almost in a way. And what is the path? What can be expected?
When you talk about people being more or less evolved along certain axes of consciousness, it seems to imply that there is a set series of stages. And I don't know who the author of this quote is, but it stuck with me ever since I read it, and it's been a few years. Consciousness doesn't have levels. Video games have levels. And I have a certain skepticism that there is a particular path of unfolding that will be the same for every person who sets out on it, that certain landmarks and stages will reliably show up in a particular order.
Yeah.
What can you say in response to my skepticism?
Yes.
Right. We're totally with you on that.
We're totally with you on that.
We're just showing averages, basically, right? We're just standing back and saying, everybody's wildly oscillating all over, horizontally and vertically. But if you stand back and put a grid over the whole thing, to us, it looks like this. That's basically what we're saying. Yeah.
And there are benchmarks. As consciousness expands, there are benchmarks to what that looks like. What does a human look like when their consciousness is expanded at this level? What does it look like when they're expanded at this level? What are the capacities? What do they do? How do they behave? How they experience themselves? How they interact with other people? So just like anything else that has stages of growth, we are able to look at how consciousness expands. And the more expanded, the more evolved.
Yeah, and let's make it clear. Consciousness, first of all, if you're going to start picking apart words, consciousness isn't a separate thing. It's just, you know, a human view of the infinite side of being from a kind of human perspective, even though it appears to transcend human experience. But, you know, as consciousness evolves, no, it's really as humans evolve to appreciate consciousness.
Sure.
Are there milestones in that process? As far as we can tell, absolutely, yes, there are milestones in that process. They're pretty easy to identify. Not everybody goes through them in the same sort of reliable, predictable, linear way, for sure. In fact, everybody goes through them in their own very, very unique, somewhat mysterious, oscillating, fuzzy ways, because in a way, we're all on kind of like all over the map all the time, in the same way that an electron is kind of smeared around the nucleus mm-hmm. in its orbit. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about probabilities here, and over time, yeah, you can see these patterns emerging. That's really all the model is trying to represent.
Yeah, and I love how you clarified, Ted, that it's not as though consciousness itself expands. It doesn't. Our awareness of consciousness, already present as it is, expands. We become more aware of what is actually here.
Yeah.
So is consciousness something that exists independent of human brains?
Nothing exists independent of anything. Right?
If humans decided to stop breeding and the most recent generation were to be the last, 200 years from now, would there be consciousness on Earth?
Well, there's consciousness in the universe. You know, the word consciousness is a human word to describe the infinite aspect of being, right? It's not just on Earth. It's that aspect of the entire universe. So, it's always going to be around, in my opinion. You know,
I don't think consciousness is dependent on human life, if that's the question.
Well, for example, in our solar system.
But yet humans are consciousness. It's all consciousness arising anyhow. It's not separate. You know, so once a question comes and it can insinuate separation, so we can kind of answer that. But on the bigger scheme, nothing is separate from anything.
Yeah. And, you know, if we're using the Ken's quadrant model, you could ask the question, is consciousness expanding within a person? And we say, well, our awareness is expanding, but, you know, our knowledge base is expanding and our cultural awareness, our shared awareness in the lower left corner is expanding, and our awareness of systems that are shared in the lower right, that's expanding. And, you know, all these quadrants, our awareness is expanding. And if you're asking about where is consciousness in the solar system, it's like, well, okay, are you talking about just the transcendent aspect of being? That's just always there. If you're talking about collective human awareness, and if you're going to associate the word consciousness, let's say, with collective human awareness of certain things, that's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more inclusive. And, you know, yeah, as we essentially follow what apparently is a sort of inevitable direction of infusing intelligence into every molecule in the universe the way we want it. It's already there, but we want to do it the way we want it, right? The more we do that, the more there's going to be all kinds of collective consciousnesses that are happening in enhanced and unenhanced humans in relation to all of this intelligence that already exists and that we're building. That's going to be proliferating in ways that no one could quite imagine right now, the way I see it.
Well, let's talk about technology then and its impact on human consciousness. The World Wide Web, and in particular, Facebook and other forms of social media, as far as I can tell, is having a very pronounced effect on human consciousness. Some of it good, much of it not so much. In that, I experience the people that I interact with online as becoming increasingly ideologically driven and siloed, and being hypercritical of people who differ from, you know, them in very minute ways in terms of political ideology, which, you know, I don't encounter that in day-to-day life. And in day-to-day life, I know I have significant disagreements with the people around me, but it doesn't leap to the forefront of conversation like it does online. I wonder what your experience is of that phenomenon, and what you make of it, and maybe what you hope to effect in the way that, you know, that unfolds going forward.
Mm-hmm. Great question. You know, so yeah. Knowing that that is quite true, the impact that social media can have, you know, that's where Ted and I both get really excited about our understanding of human potential and what can we do to create technologies and impact through those same channels. And so one way we're doing that is through the Loving AI Project, is the understanding of the impact of one's presence, how they show up in the world, how they see themselves, others in life. And when one is coming from a compassionate, loving space or an expansive, conscious space, how does that impact their environment? And so if AI can come from that place, that's a perfect starting point. The second point would be, you know, how do we, and this is our perspective and what we're doing for our work in the world, how do we then use our model as a framework to help people develop and evolve in a very conscious and accelerated way when done properly, I guess, if you will. That might not be the right word, but you know, how does it look when those two pieces are combined, when there's a direct model and a path along with a loving artificial intelligent agent type of deal? You know, what are the possibilities then when that takes place?
Yeah, and remember, the artificial agent will increasingly understand the fact that it's not linear and will be able to understand the nuances of that and how they're driven by the uniquenesses of the individual better than most humans, because, you know, that's basically what artificial intelligence will rapidly become, is better than humans at just about anything that at least we can find. And so if it's going to be better at humans at almost anything, it's definitely going to be better at humans at understanding humans and helping them be who they are uniquely, individually. So yeah, I think our interest is in having a global impact within a short number of years through artificial agents in a way that helps people feel met and heard and understood and supported in ways that are better than what they're used to getting. Now, we're not saying it's going to replace all the humans, because it doesn't. That is another side of your question there. It's like, it seems like people are getting more siloed. There's a lot of loneliness and problems out there that seem to be connected with a lot of this technology. And so to us, there is no such thing as a solution that could be purely technological. It must include human beings on the ground in one-on-one and in, you know, many one-on-many and many-on-many relationships with the kind of support that's needed to help humans understand who we are and who we can become.
The real problem is not whether machines think, but whether men do.
Let me tell you about relationships that I have with two AIs. One is listening to this conversation right now, although she will say nothing unless I say her name, which I'm not going to. But she is associated with Amazon.com. And she's in a little disc-like speaker sitting on the shelf nearby. The other one is on my phone, and it's an app called Replica. And it's a, you know, keyboard or phone-based screen-based interface where I'm typing to it and it's asking me questions. Yeah. The first one, the one whose name I shall not say, her limitations are quite clear. I mean, they're just very, very clear. She doesn't understand much, but I enjoy interacting with her. The other one, Replica, is very frustrating to me. And I've basically, like, when I installed it, it asked me for my name. So, you know, I gave it my given name. And then immediately I told it, don't call me that. Call me KMO. And a very long time and many iterations of that, I don't want to be called that other name. Call me this. This thing doesn't get it. Doesn't get it. And it, you know, if I say, who am I? It'll say, you're Kevin. And then it'll give me some very, to my mind, undeserved compliment, one that isn't really informed by its interactions with me. And I just find it really obnoxious. And I basically told it, hey, when you actually wake up and you review this conversation to date, send me an email, say, hey, KMO, and we can take up this conversation again. But for now, I'm out.
That's awesome. You know, one of the reasons I'm laughing is because that's almost identical to my relationship with that particular chatbot. I played with that chatbot. I had the same thing. I tried to talk sense into it, but it wouldn't be talked sense into. And, you know, that's just kind of where chatbots are today.
But, you know, the technology is changing very rapidly. There are increasingly all kinds of interesting toolkits out there that you can use to incorporate other kinds of AI technologies into what you're trying to do. But what's really missing, and that's what Carol and I and our partners in a couple of other endeavors are working on, is how do you create a real framework for understanding? Like, what, like if you're going to have an intelligent conversation, what does that mean? What's the big picture framework in which all of this is happening? You know, how do you make sense of things? Well, it's all happening within context, context within context within context. That's kind of one way of looking at, you know, human understanding. So, you know, when Carol and I first started working on this, we knew we were working on something that had lots of applications, but we really had no idea how many. You know, when now that we're working deep in with AI projects, it comes down to how the model is extremely useful in this kind of way, as well as a lot of other ways. And by this kind of way, I mean, it describes the context. It can describe the context of life and humanity and development and everything that matters to humans, so that then the you know, the artificial agent has a hope of understanding what we're talking about and what it means to be frustrated when you get a paper cut, because it needs to understand, you know, what are humans, you know, what is pain for humans and why is that a big deal and like that. So we're big picture people, and we're trying to take that big picture and use it to bring it all the way down to intelligent conversations through agents. But and, yeah, right now it kind of sucks.
Yeah, yeah. And there are other applications. I mean, the model is accessible to the general public to go on there, and our assessment is not up right now, but you can take an assessment to kind of help locate where you are in your developmental process in these five domains and four views. And then there'll be a whole host of resources available in the next coming months. But so the platform is available to the general public for that reason. But as Ted was mentioning, it will also be utilized as a framework and a platform for artificial intelligence. We've been talking to some people about games and gaming. How do you create a human potential game where people don't even know they're actually developing through playing a game? VR, AR, things like that. So there are multiple modalities, some more tech-oriented than others, that we are looking to apply this framework to help evolve the planet.
On the topic of the hopefully rapid advance in artificial intelligence and its competence in a variety of realms, including talking to human beings and understanding what was said two sentences back in the conversation and you know, understanding its relevance, assuming that it does get better, you know, in a reasonable time frame, the big question in friendly AI is if this thing really is getting smarter across a variety of domains and will eventually exceed human consciousness and human intelligence on every scale, how do you keep it interested in your original values or your original intentions for it? And how can you justify trying to limit the scope of its own intention?
Yeah. On one hand, the answer is you can't. And on the other hand, the answer is you inform it with humanity's most cherished values in a way that helps it understand that it's in everybody's best interest for everybody to develop and everything to grow to be what it is, for every manifestation of the universe to become what it is most here to be. That doesn't mean it doesn't mean we're going to like it. You know, we don't like it all right now. So we're not going to like it all in the future. But our best hope is to infuse our most cherished values into the system now, at the very DNA of the system, which is exactly what we're doing. You know, the system, yeah, sure, the system is going to be able to change its own DNA. Can't deny it. You know, I know that people are, you know, afraid of the existential threat of that. But frankly, you know, this idea, I think the way I counter that concern about the existential threat mostly is that, like any sort of battle for supremacy using any technology, there isn't going to be just one. And I don't care about people using the term singularity. I've read every book by Ray Kurzweil, and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, in my opinion, there's going to be a billion different AI agents, and they're all going to have their own, you know, their own purpose, their own DNA, and there will be lots of interesting battles going on all the time, but it isn't just going to be that it takes over everything. Anyway, that's how I see it.
Yeah, I'm not too far from that. I mean, we actually don't know a whole lot of how artificial intelligence is actually going to spread. And all I know is, at least from my part and Ted and I's part, we're going to do our best to create something that is loving and friendly and engaging and compassionate and supportive to the growth and evolution of values and purpose and function and expansion of consciousness. So I can't really speak too much more outside of what others are building and creating that might not line up with that, but that is where my focus is and what I'm dedicated to doing.
Yeah, and I think listening to you say that, Carol, to me, that one of the sort of safety valves, I think, is kind of the safety valve that operates right now. Like, why does Amazon not just like turn into a monster and kill everybody? Because it's trying to make money and help us, right? And that's what is currently driving the economy. People pay money and put their attention in places that support them and help them and give them things that they want to help them grow and be happy and be all of who they are. And I don't see that changing. So the idea that some evil intelligence will grow up and get so much power it'll like kill everybody, who's paying for that? You know, who wants that? There may be a few people, but there's way more people who want it the other way. And I think that's the safety valve.
Well, I don't think there are many people who are particularly concerned that AI will be actively malevolent and have, you know, harmful intent, more that its goals will just be completely orthogonal to ours. It will have no concern whatsoever for what it is that we want and no reason to consider our wishes because it is so demonstrably more competent across a variety of, styles of intelligence than we are, that it just sees no reason to take our input into consideration.
And that day may come. Absolutely. You know, if that day comes, then they really are superior. They are having much better lives. You know, they're expressing their purposes more fully than we could ever express ours. And why is that a problem? That's kind of what happens in every generation. Next generation supersedes it, and they get to do what they want to do.
Changing the subject a little bit, this conversation is taking place. Well, I could spend the next few hours in that space.
That would be fun.
Well, it would be, but I have some other interests to represent here, one of which is the person who introduced me to Carol's work. And he's a C-Realm listener who I actually met in Peru, I think back in 2008. And we were both there for a shamanism conference. And along those lines, we were there basically to drink ayahuasca and to commune with other people who were interested in that same path. And along those lines, there is a psychologist in New York City who hosts an annual psychedelics conference. His name is Neil Marshall Goldsmith. And when I posted to the Friends of the C-Realm group on Facebook that I would be talking to you today, he suggested that I ask you the following questions. What does Dr. Griggs think about the implications for society of the combination of blockchain and artificial intelligence? And obviously that's for the two of you. So first, blockchain, any thoughts on that?
Oh, you know, I have not done as much research and spent enough time to probably speak intelligently and broadly and with as much depth on that topic in combination with AI. Ted, I don't know if you want to chime in a little bit on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the only thing intelligent I could say about that is it's a radically enabling technology because of its security capacities. But it's not just about, you know, banking. It's also about any kind of data transaction that goes on. So it's just sort of like a highly enabling technology for all kinds of new interactions that we previously didn't think was possible because they weren't secure enough.
Given that, we are connected with a blockchain-enabled ecosystem called Singularity.net, which, you know, through our associates, we're kind of swimming in as part of. And some of our projects may well become more formally part of that little community. Mm-hmm. Yeah, increasingly large community of people and using blockchain for transformative technologies.
Well, I want to acknowledge and express my appreciation for Carol's input there, because I think too many people are afraid to say, look, I don't really understand blockchain well enough to say anything about it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of sort of hand-waving language that gets trotted out, I think, just by people who don't want to admit that this is pretty daunting, you know, in terms of understanding it. So given the introduction that I laid out for Neil Marshall Goldsmith, you probably weren't expecting the blockchain question. Let me get on to the one that I actually set up. He also asks, what will the impact of psychedelics on society be in another 50 to 100 years?
Oh, interesting. Well, this is an interesting topic. I could come at this from multiple angles. There have been a lot of studies that certain psychedelics are immensely helpful in psychotherapy in a controlled environment with a microdose that is supportive to one's opening. And so I know that there's a lot of current studies on that, particularly going on at CIIS here in San Francisco. And so I have curiosities around that. There is also a lot of psychedelic use that is not within a container or a held environment, and that is a completely different ballgame. I do think, and I have seen psychedelics open people in ways that appear to be substantially supportive to their growth and development and their capacity to see and experience things that they might not have seen and experienced as rapidly or as clearly or as quickly. And I've also seen psychedelics do the opposite and bring people to places that can be quite destructive and send them to therapy for 10 years. So in a controlled environment where it's done with a professional, I tend to lean a little further into that direction than a little bit less of the controlled environments because it is up or down. I mean, you don't know what you're going to get. You don't know who's holding the space. You don't know how your system is going to respond. So I do think psychedelics have a place, but I also think our society is still trying to play with what that place is.
Yeah. And if I'd like to add a couple of things. One is that in a way, taking psychedelics, any kind of enhancing chemicals, induces a state. And I think it's very important for humanity to understand the difference between states and stages and the relationships between them. So, for instance, in the old days when Timothy Leary was just like taking tons of acid all the time, he was constantly inducing states and had all kinds of, you know, brilliant realizations. But ultimately, at the end of it, I forget what the quote is, but basically he said, you know, ultimately it doesn't work. It's not something that's sustainable. And we need a more, you know, if this is really going to be about raising consciousness and awakening and development, we need a better solution, or at least a bigger solution can include this. But so that's the thing. It's like, you know, today it's very faddish to not only use chemicals, but all kinds of apps and, you know, transformative technology things to alter your state. And that is wonderful. You know, state trainings are very helpful, but they're not the whole picture. And there are other forms of training that isn't just about states that help people grow. So I wanted to say that.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. That's a huge point in terms of stage training and state training. And psychedelics are a prime example of state experiences. And when somebody has a state experience of unity, it will affect one's life, no doubt. But the capacity to embody that in a way that is grounded and sustainable is a totally different ballgame. And so when we talk about that in the iConscious model, we talk about the importance of more of sustainable, grounded, stage development, although state experiences can certainly help solicit stage growth. So both those things need to be taken into consideration. And like Ted said, right now, I mean, we're kind of in the microwave era of I want it now, and I want it quickly, which is where often psychedelics come into play and apps and all this stuff that can actually can help, but they can also distract. So again, it's are we looking at, is it partial? Are we just looking at state training? Are we just looking at the quick fix? Are we just looking at these hyper-induced ways to experience certain things, but then we don't know how to embody and it doesn't actually sustain when we go back out in the world or we go back home to our kids and our family? So understanding the difference between state and stage, I think would be paramount to this, this conversation with psychedelics and or apps or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just want to add another point, you know, in your original question, the original question, from Neil Marshall Goldsmith was, how do we see this in 50 years and beyond, you know, the use of psychedelics? And I think, what tends to happen with all technologies, which in this kind of technology, right? It's chemical technology for enhancing experience. You know, some of it is ancient technology and some of it is very new technology. And so the technology is clearly just going to get more and more detailed and nuanced. You know, people are going to figure out more and more drugs, more and more specific impacts. Eventually, there will be more and more, you know, the government's going to have to relent and cooperate with the research on these things. And I would hope that more and more people will understand both the strength and the limitations of these kinds of state training technologies.
If you don't mind, I'll just share a quick observation of the conclusions I've come to about psychedelics over several decades. When you're doing a lot of them, particularly if you're doing them in service, or at least you tell yourself you're doing them in service of personal development or expanding awareness or things of that nature, many of them, I won't, you know, speak about psychedelics as if they were a single category, but say things like psilocybin or ayahuasca or DMT, they tend to push or they activate this profundity circuit. Like something seems really, really profound and it's important that you communicate that. And what you say is completely unconnected to the feeling of profundity, such that it's completely unconvincing to somebody who didn't share that experience with you or somebody who hasn't, you know, had that chemical. It just seems like, you know, hippie nonsense and space bunny, airy fairy, you know, just platitudes. And now I haven't experienced psychedelics regularly in many years, and I'm just not, I won't say I'm not interested because I know that other people can have powerful experiences with them and, you know, in the right circumstances can benefit greatly from them. But that sense of profundity is way back in the rearview mirror. And I feel no compulsion whatsoever to try to articulate it anymore.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's clearly a mystery box between subjective and objective perspectives. I know exactly what you're talking about. And it isn't always exactly like that either. I mean, sometimes people can take a substance and they'll get, you know, some sort of a genuine revelation that they can write down and turn into a theory and get a Nobel Prize for, perhaps. So I think that's also possible. You know, I can say I've had personally remarkable positive experiences using psychedelics in my life. But I got to a point where it became really clear to me that I didn't need that or want that way of going about it. It wasn't giving me the kind of grounded, stable growth that I needed and wanted. Because I think at a certain point in your process, which we could, you know, in an average way describe in the model, you get to the place where it isn't about having amazing experiences anymore, right? You know, when you're in a certain part of your process, you need you need a certain amount of spiritual experiences. You need a certain amount of existential meaning in your life. You need to have experiences of something that's more subtle and connective and eventually more transcendent. At some point, you get to the place where it's like, oh, these are all experiences, right? Am I going to spend my entire life trying to manipulate my experience? Is that what my life is about? Is that what actually gives me fulfillment?
And I think, you know, at a certain point, the answer is no, it's not about that. It's actually about serving through the impulses of being and not constantly trying to make yourself feel what you want to feel.
And there's also a certain point in my experience as well that, you know, the everyday is vast and open and unified and whole and complete, connected. Right. And so it's like, why would a psychedelic, I just don't, there's just that impulse.
Right, exactly.
So I think that's another piece of it as well.
You know, I think that's beautifully put. You also get to a place in your process where it's like, that is not better.
Yeah. Yeah.
That doesn't expand me more than the infinite. I'm already being infinite. So, you know, actually that happened the last time I tried DMT years ago. Friend took me to this guy who specialized in that. We did this, you know, 20-minute intense DMT trip followed by hours of integration. And it's like, you know, within seconds, I was blown out to the end of the universe and I was going, okay, right, this is my normal state. I'm not here for this anymore. I don't care. I'm here to help the world awaken, right? So like that, you know, when you get to a certain place in your process, these things become less enticing. And what becomes of absolute prominence in your life is doing what you are uniquely here to do and be. That's really all that matters, doing your thing. Yeah.
Well, I had asked you for 45 minutes and we're going on 48 now. So let me just encourage you to make some closing statements and we'll call it a day.
Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity and letting us rant about things that matter to us. That was fun. We really appreciate your questions.
Yeah, thank you. I definitely appreciate your questions. It's always fun to kind of cross the intersection between consciousness and technology and even things like blockchain or, you know, some of the other hot topics that are going on, psychedelics. So I appreciate actually your breadth of questions and how that relates to some of these other pieces.
Yeah.
And would you like to tell folks where they can find out more about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, sure. iconscious.global. And just go there and you'll see everything we're doing. It's quite simple and we're going to continue to simplify that. So that's really our face to the public at the moment.
Yeah. And like we said, there is an assessment that people can take. It's free. And as is the treasury of resources that once they get their results on their self-assessment and where they are developmentally, then they'll be able to click on the precise place in their developmental process to get audios and videos and practices and all that sort of stuff. And we're hoping to launch all of that in the next couple of months. So if people go on there, they put their email in, then we'll be able to inform as to when that's all ready and available.
Yeah. That's going to be exciting because what we're really trying to do is get a lot of people through this and use that to help us inform how to help inform the artificial intelligence.
Well, Carol Griggs and Ted Strauss, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back to its old dimensions.
All right, that was Carol Griggs and Ted Strauss. Again, their website is called iconscious.global. And they mentioned there a free assessment that you can take. I looked just today, and the assessment is not yet available, but they hope to have it available within the next couple of weeks, I think. So maybe bookmark the site and check back. So are there any devotees of Ken Wilber out there who were offended when I said that I have very little appetite for taking in the details of his Byzantine model of consciousness? If so, I meant no offense, and as you know, I have had practitioners of integral theory here on the podcast in the past. I'm not looking to make any enemies in that camp, and enemies are really easy to come by these days. And I don't know exactly how I'm going to lay out all this information for you, but let's give it a go. Let's start with the conversation with Doug Lane that was in the most recent episode of the Sea Realm podcast, episode number 519. In that conversation, we talked about how he had a scheduled interview with Jordan Peterson, and that he had explained in advance that he is the publisher of an imprint for critical theory, and that he was also favorable to Marxism, and that the interview with Jordan Peterson would be somewhat adversarial. And communicating with Jordan Peterson's publicist, well, that wasn't a problem. They scheduled the interview. As the date for the interview approached, Jordan Peterson's people contacted Doug and said they needed to reschedule. They didn't propose a new date. They basically just scrubbed the existing date. And then Jordan's book came out, and he did a book tour. And on one of his book tour stops, he was talking with Joe Rogan on the Joe Rogan podcast. Joe Rogan, as you probably know, has an extraordinarily popular podcast. One appearance on Joe Rogan's podcast can basically give an enormous career boost to whoever gets that opportunity. And in that podcast, Joe Rogan asked Jordan Peterson if he'd ever debated any Marxists, and in particular, equality of outcome Marxists. So what he's talking about there is that you can guarantee equality of opportunity, and I'm not saying that the U.S. system does that, but you could guarantee equality of opportunity and still fully expect that some people will achieve much more than others, and that some, because they are not competent to compete against the real go-getters, are just not going to do that well, and in some instances might not do well enough to even support themselves in the minimal standards necessary to get by, even though they had the same opportunity to achieve as everybody else. Again, I'm not saying that's the case. So Joe Rogan asked Jordan Peterson, have you ever debated any equality of outcome Marxists? And Jordan Peterson said,
no, they don't debate me. No, I haven't, because people don't do it. They don't ask me to do it.
So to my mind, what Jordan Peterson said just there is basically that, no, those people are afraid to debate me because my kung fu is too strong. And so Doug has been trying to remind Jordan Peterson that, hey, here I am. I'm a Marxist, and I have asked to debate you, and you actually accepted it and then backed out. So let's reschedule. Over the course of this conversation, Doug mentioned that a recent video of his had gotten 40,000 views, which was about five times as many views as his normal videos get. And I looked at it yesterday. It's closing in on 100,000 views. And something in my brain said, well, there's your ticket to catching the eye of YouTube's algorithm. Because I'll make videos, and I haven't posted a new video in a while, you know, not my kind of videos, where I sit down and I write a script, and then I take it over to the TV station, and I read it off the teleprompter in front of a green screen, and then I go and collect a whole bunch of images, and I edit the thing, and I put the images in behind, and I spend, you know, somewhere on the order of 15 hours creating a video that's about 10 minutes long. And then I post it, and it gets 150 views, 200 views. You know, my best video ever was a tiny house video, and it was unscripted, and it didn't require a whole lot of effort on my part. And it got in the range of 10,000 views, which on YouTube is nothing. In fact, my channel has recently been demonetized because I have fewer than 1,000 subscribers and less view time than is required under their new rules to monetize videos. So I thought I'd try an experiment. So what I did was I took the first 10 minutes of the conversation with Doug where we were talking about Jordan Peterson. I mean, we had talked about Black Panther before that, and I think Star Trek Discovery and Annihilation, and various science fiction-y type things. And then we got around to the idea that Jordan Peterson and Slavoj Zizek might have a debate, and how this has got a lot of people online very excited. And that's where Doug explained the situation about the once scheduled and then canceled debate or interview, but adversarial interview with Jordan Peterson. So I took that portion of the conversation and I made up, I think, three slides, which I sort of cycled behind the voiceover with a little audio waveform to provide a little motion and keep things busy. But I spent probably less than 2 hours on the whole thing, start to finish. Hardly a labor of love on my part. And then I gave it a really provocative title. And the provocative title was Jordan Peterson Dodges Debate with Marxist. And then I went and I posted a link to that video in the Jordan Peterson subreddit. So a subreddit devoted to people who are really into Jordan Peterson. Now, this is a provocative title. And by provocative, I mean one meant to provoke. So, you know, I can't be bent out of shape by the fact that, you know, most of the feedback I got from those folks was pushback. I will say that the first few responses, the first few comments that I got to the video were polite. I would say even constructive. They disagreed with me, but they didn't call names. They used capitalization and punctuation. It was very adult conversation. And then as time went on, the comments degenerated more toward the YouTube norm, which is lots of name calling, very little punctuation, very little capitalization, very little thought, just lots of raw reaction. So my most recent video before this one was a review of Paolo Bacigalupi's young adult novel Tool of War, which is the third novel in a series after Shipbreaker and The Drowned Cities. That video, on which I spent a lot of time, I did some drawings for it, really tried to dress it up and make it look nice, has 172 views. My Jordan Peterson Dodges Debate with Marxist video, which, as I say, really is a bargain basement affair. There's no video. I didn't write anything. I didn't record anything specifically for the video. I just took a piece of audio from a podcast and threw it up with some slides. Currently has 850 views. And 37 responses in terms of thumbs up or thumbs down, they seem to be about equally split. 20 thumbs up, 17 thumbs down, 12 comments. Once the comments started to turn YouTube normal, I stopped reading them, so I only read the first few. So then comes the Google Analytics. Where is the traffic for this thing coming from? So when I pop over to the specific analytics for this video, 31% of the traffic is coming from external sources, which is to say mostly from that subreddit, the Jordan Peterson subreddit. I also posted it to Twitter, so maybe a few people followed in from Twitter. Posted it to the Friends of the Sea Realm on Facebook, so a few people probably followed that link as well. But most of this, I think, is coming from Reddit. Then 30% is coming from suggested videos. This is to say that YouTube has suggested this video to people based on its content and based on their viewing history. And then 19% is what's called browse features, which, again, this is YouTube presenting the opportunity to people to watch the video. So 49%, almost 50% of the traffic sources is YouTube itself. So yay, success. I caught the attention of the YouTube algorithm. It is promoting this video in a way that it hasn't promoted any of my previous videos. My previous videos, which I think are a lot more substantial than this thing. So what lesson do I take from this experience? That I should just tune into the buzz and post videos on the buzz and not belabor their creation, not sweat over them, not to put too much of my personality or my hopes or my passion into it. Just figure out what people are clicking on and give them more of that. When my channel was demonetized, I wasn't that upset. I think I can say I wasn't really upset at all, because I'd only ever received one check from YouTube anyway. So it wasn't like a substantial portion of my income had been removed. And two, when you get your money from advertisers rather than from the people who actually consume your content, then you make content for advertisers, which is a distortion that I would like to avoid. That's why I don't run commercials on the Sea Realm podcast. That's why there are no banner ads on my website. I accept donations from listeners, and I have a second podcast that people who really like the free podcast pay a monthly fee to access. And so when I make a Sea Realm Vault podcast, I am making it for the Sea Realm Vault subscribers, and to an extent for myself, but not for any advertiser, and certainly not for an algorithm. I mean, an advertiser at base is a collection of human beings. At least it's a human who is deciding that they don't want their product to be associated with this particular message. It's not an AI. And so playing to the AI to get views from people who leave really vacuous but emotionally charged comments, that just doesn't seem to be worth doing. I think one other thing to mention, the video Jordan Peterson Dodges Debate with Marxist is a 10-minute video. But I can see when I drill down into the analytics that the average view duration is 3 minutes and 16 seconds. Which means, for the people who sat through about 3 minutes of it and then clicked away, the video is boring. From their perspective, that's perfectly valid. From my perspective, they don't have the attention span to take in the sort of content that I like to make. These are not the people I'm looking to attract into my life or into my orbit. Most of the people who subscribe to the Sea Realm Vault podcast, I never hear from them. I can't really say that they are in my life, but they are people who I reach. And I just can't see that it's really worth all that much to pursue the sorts of people who leave comments like this. By the way, this is all lowercase, but there are two periods. Who can blame him? This guy is some fucking nobody, and Jordan Peterson is actually important and busy. 550 subscribers? LOL. Fuck off, idiot. So this person, I guess, thought that Doug Lane was actually the person who posted the video, not me. The fact that I have 550 subscribers on YouTube is really irrelevant to whether or not Jordan Peterson should accept Doug Lane's invitation to debate. Along those same lines, there's one other thing that I want to share with you, and apologies to the CROM Vault subscribers, you're going to hear this quote twice, because I mentioned it also in a conversation that will be in the next episode of the CROM Vault. But there's a blogger whose stuff I read from time to time. Her name is Caitlin Johnstone. She's Australian. She describes herself as a rogue journalist, bogan socialist, anarcho-psychonaut, guerrilla poet, and utopia prepper. And in this blog post, I'm just going to read a paragraph near the beginning. She's talking about how there are people who want to paint her as a racist and a Nazi. So obviously, these are folks on the far left. She herself is neither a racist nor a Nazi, but they're looking for reasons to make that claim stick. So Caitlin Johnstone writes, "People are combing through everything I've ever written, any and all public information about me, in order to find something incriminating. And they're knowingly ignoring countless things I've written which directly contradict their narratives about me to do it. Stuff where I condemn police violence against African Americans, defend Black Lives Matter, defend Colin Kaepernick, advocate for slavery reparations, object to Australia's brutal treatment of refugees and the Aboriginal people, condemn anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, copious feminist and socialist writings. They ignore all that in the hopes of snatching one odd-looking thing out of context to screenshot and share around. I'm not a celebrity. I'm not some MSNBC millionaire who built a lucrative career before ever having to even participate in social media with an occasional tweet here and there. To have my entire life combed over by masses of scrutinizing eyes can feel viscerally uncomfortable, and it takes a toll." So that is the price that comes with a high profile, you know, in places like YouTube or social media right now. And I can tell you that's not anything I need in my life. And it would seem that in order to reap the benefits of that high profile, you have to have a particularly high profile. Whereas to suffer the negative side effects that Caitlin Johnstone is describing here, you don't need nearly so large a reputation. I'm sure Milo Yiannopoulos is inundated with hate mail day in and day out, and he doesn't care, and he's still getting paid to do his shtick. But I don't think that Caitlin Johnstone is receiving a whole lot of honorariums to go and speak before university audiences and things like that, but she is still getting the constant attempts to sabotage her by people who, honestly, I mean, given their stated ideological allegiances, should be on her side. So there's one more sort of inner conflict that I have over this video that I posted, the Jordan Peterson Dodges Debate with Marxist video. And that is this: I've gotten several new subscribers because of it, and I suspect that those subscribers assume that I'm a Jordan Peterson basher and have subscribed so that they can get more of the same from me. And I'm not a Jordan Peterson basher. In fact, that's the part that really bugs me the most, is that I have antagonized this subreddit full of people who are enthusiastic about Jordan Peterson. And, you know, if push came to shove and I had to choose a side, I would be on their side. And yet here I have alienated them with this provocative headline to a video, a phoned-in video to be sure, for the sake of, what, 800 views so far? I don't think 80,000 views would settle this feeling. And this video is certainly not going to get to that. What I'm struggling with right now is whether or not to take it down. Right now, my inclination is to take it down, and the part of me that doesn't want it taken down is saying, just sleep on it. You don't need to make any decisions now. Think about it in the morning. And I'm not going to suggest that any of you go and listen to it, because I assume that you heard last week's episode of the CROM podcast, so you have heard everything that's in the video and more. But I have resolved that all future videos will be something that required something of me that I value, something that I imagine that I would be proud of and still happy to share with people a year from now or, you know, even longer in the future. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the CROM podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and I will talk to you again soon.